but they pay a tremendous price for that security. They sacrifice freedom and opportunity. Government is the mechanism through which we seek to protect the rights of the citizen to seek opportunity, to have individual freedom, and to obtain for himself some measure of security. One of the greatest dangers today is that we in the United States will place on government the responsibility of providing economic security for all of our people. Those whom the government subsidizes can quite properly expect to be government regulated. We in agriculture have found that our demands for government farm price fixing have resulted in drastic control of crop acreage and restrictions on the right to produce. We in the United States who believe in freedom can win the battle for the minds of men and defeat the slave state idea if we turn away from increasing dependence upon a more and more powerful federal government and place greater reliance upon individual initiative. The threat to our freedom is real, and it comes from within, not without. We must reduce our emphasis upon security and increasingly seek freedom of opportunity. Well, I know that many of you think that's a lot of words, and perhaps it is. I personally have been convinced in recent years that the direction that we have been moving is in the direction towards greater and greater dependence upon government and a more powerful state that in time will result in putting our folks under the same kind of government slavery that exists in other countries. Well, I think we are at the crossroads. I don't believe that we can go much further in the direction we're going and still turn back or turn away from the slave state idea. I'm convinced that the slave state idea is gaining, not only in this country, not only in other countries, but in this country. That the idea that government is the solution for all of our ills is just a part of the idea that you turn from the individual to big government. Now, if we're at this crossroads, how far have we come? Have we yet time to turn? Well, percentage-wise, might be as good a way to figure whether or not we've come down the road towards socialism and big governmentism or whatever you want to call it. I don't care what you call it. It's big government in one form or another. Socialism and communism are the same thing. They're just different degrees of big government. And big government means taking more and more of the income of individuals to do things for the people which they formerly did for themselves. That's about as simple, I think, as it can be stated. And so the best way to measure how far we have come down the road towards dependence upon big government, perhaps, is to figure out the percentage of total national income that is spent by government of all kinds. Now, if it was an entirely free democracy and there was no government at all, we would spend all of our income ourselves, wouldn't we? But that's not desirable, of course. We've found that it's necessary to go together under some form of government to collectively spend part of our income for protection against foreign military power, for protection against evil elements in our society. We've gone farther and decided that collectively and together we can spend part of our money for schools and for roads, many things that we consider good. And then in the last 20 to 30 years, we suddenly decided that that was not far enough. We should go farther in this direction of collectively spending our income. And we very rapidly increased the expenditures for government from about 10 to 15% of national income of some 30 years ago, up to the present time, approximately 35% of national income goes to government. About 35% of national income spent by government. Now, would you agree with me if we spent, say, 80 to 100% of our total income. That's everything that we made, everything that we took in from our jobs, our salaries, the crops that we sell. If we spent from 80 to 100% of that through government, we would be in a slave state status, wouldn't we? No question about it. The last estimate I saw on Russia was that government there spends a total of approximately 73% of the total national income. That is, taxes or some other form is used to take away the income of the people to the extent of 73%, leaving 27% for them to spend themselves. They're 73% slave and 27% free in Russia. Using the same kind of analysis, we in this country have come to the place where we're 35% slave and 65% free, as contrasted to about 80-20 of some 30 years ago. Now, that wouldn't in itself be so alarming if we were not increasing the proportion of our income that we turn over to government each year by 1 1/3% per year. And in the course of 50 years, just half the time that BMANT has existed, we will have a higher proportion, if this continues, of our income spent by government than Russia now spends. I say to you, we're on the road towards the slave state system without any question, unless we do something about it. Now, for fear that someone may think that this talk and the things that I've been emphasizing are tinged with politics, I want to point out one example of the way we have come and how we got there. And I don't know where to turn except agriculture, because that's the business I know best. Back in 1920 period, after the First World War, agriculture had a very difficult time. And we started to turn to government for price assistance. This was in the administration of Calvin Coolidge, a rock-ribbed Republican. And we attempted to pass the farm legislation that would do something about price, and it was first defeated and then vetoed. And then came the administration of Herbert Hoover, another Republican. And under Herbert Hoover's administration, there was passed, at his suggestion, and put into law the first farm price legislation, an act of Congress that did just about the same thing that we're doing now, bought farm products and stored them, hoping that the price would go up, which it didn't. And they lost $500,000, $500 million, beg your pardon, which was a tremendous sum of money at that time, and the law was repealed as a failure. Then a little later on, in the 30s, we adopted legislation which the argument then, and I, along with many of you, used the same argument. The argument in favor of this price-fixing legislation by government was that all other groups had government help. Industry had its tariffs. The retailers, and the retailers today in the town of BMANT, have fair trade pricing legislation, which is government price-fixing in one form. A little later on, we had minimum wage laws, and folks say today farmers should have prices fixed by government because we have minimum wage laws for labor. And so we use the excuse that everybody else is doing evil, therefore you should do evil if it's evil. And we adopted this legislation to fix price. Now, I'm not going through all the history of it, except to say the only trouble was that it didn't work very well in the case of agriculture. And in the last 5 years, with this legislation on the books, the price of farm products and the income of farm people has gone down 24%. And yet we just finished, a few weeks ago, quite a scrap in the House of Representatives in attempting to get rid of this, the part of this device. Not to do away with price support, but to do away with the price-fixing feature. And we found quite a battle on our hands, because there are those in politics who do not want to give up this idea that they can do something about prices. Now, most farmers know today that political determination of price is not as good as economic determination. People more interested in getting cheap food than they are in high-priced food. Only 13% of the people on farms, and they're the ones that's wanting higher prices. 87% of them want lower prices, and they can outvote us. So in the long run, they'll set the prices low. But it doesn't work, and farm prices have gone down. And the crops that have had the highest price support are now selling on the free market at the lowest prices. Isn't that a peculiar situation? It hasn't worked. But when we went as a farm organization to Congress to try to do away with the price-fixing features of it, we found many of the congressmen didn't want to give up that hold on the farmer's pocketbook. And to show you further that this was non-partisan, this idea is non-partisan, that we can do better without some of these government regulations, I want to point out that some of the folks who voted against the farmers' best interests are from right this area of the United States, and they're not all of one political party. For instance, such a lineup as Congressman Hope and Congressman Springer and our own Senator Douglas were on the same side, have been on the same side of this issue of opposing the return to economic pricing and the continuation of political pricing. While on the other side, such prominent Democrats as Senator Anderson and Senator Byrd have joined with Senator Aiken of the Republicans to move in the direction of freeing up farm prices, or freeing us from this price support straitjacket. Well, that simply tells you, by way of illustration, how agriculture got into this mess of turning more and more and too much, in my opinion, to government for assistance. And also illustrates how far we have come as far as agriculture is concerned. Now, why do I say that it's important for us to turn the other direction and to place greater emphasis on the individual? I have a little story that I've told a lot of times, and it might be just as good a place to wind this up, because you'll probably remember it longer than you will anything I say. It seems that Pat, who worked in a machine shop on one side of the cemetery, and he worked the night shift and got through at midnight, lived in a little house on the other side of the graveyard, and each night at midnight, going home, he had to walk a quarter mile to get to the end of the cemetery and cross, and then a quarter mile back. Extra half-mile walk, and took time and effort. So one night, the moon was shining full, and Pat said to himself, "There's no use you being so superstitious. Instead of walking around the cemetery to get home, you just as well cut directly across." And so he did, and nothing happened, and each night after that, he cut across the cemetery at midnight. Well, finally, one night, the moon was not shining, and unbeknown to Pat, the sexton dug a fresh grave right in his path, and he fell in, straight down 6 feet. Not being a very tall fellow, he couldn't get out. He tried every way he could to get out of that grave, and he couldn't make it. Finally, he decided that he couldn't get out till morning, and thought he'd have to wait till morning till someone found him. He sat down in the shadows at one end of the grave to wait, and he hadn't much more and settled down till another fellow came across the cemetery and fell right in with him. Well, the other fellow didn't see Pat, and Pat thought, "I'll not let him know I'm here. I'll just wait and see how he gets out, then I can get out." Well, he sat and watched the other fellow go through all the same motions that he'd done, and the other fellow didn't have any more luck than he did, so Pat finally thought he ought to let him know he's there, and he said in a deep voice, "You'll never get out." But he did. Well, that fellow had incentive. Now, incentive is a wonderful thing, and it's the ingredient of this free enterprise system that's most important. Incentive. The incentive to work. The incentive to try new things. The incentive to conduct research that's so essential to our progress. The incentive to risk, to take chances.